Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. In today's podcast, we present part two of a panel containing four members of President John F. Kennedy's Executive Committee, Robert S. McNamara, George W. Ball, McGeorge Bundy, and U. Alexis Johnson, as they reconvene 20 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis to reflect on the lessons learned.
President's chosen option into effect and mandating the work that had to be done throughout the executive branch, military and civil authorities, from the time of the decision was made to start with the quarantine option. You got some points there, Bob?
Yes, I think the implementation or the monitoring of the implementation of the president's decision was a very important element of the action, because it wasn't initially clear to everyone what the decision was. Quarantine, normally thought to be synonymous with blockade. Blockade, what's a blockade? Well, the American Navy had been operating blockades at various times in the past 200 years, and there were certain rules of procedure how you run a blockade, and the most important element of a blockade was to stop things from going through whatever you were blockading. However, that wasn't the president's decision. The president's decision was, we wish to remove the offensive weapons from Cuba. We want to convey to Khrushchev a message that that is our single objective. It's a very narrow objective. We wish to apply the minimum pressure necessary to accomplish it. We don't wish to paint you in a corner. We don't wish to humiliate you. We particularly don't wish to escalate militarily any more than is absolutely essential to achieve that objective. Now, that's not what a blockade normally means. This wasn't called a blockade. I understand that. It was called a quarantine. But if you said, what are we doing to the average person in the Pentagon or in the executive, we're blockading Cuba. Well, we're not blockading Cuba in the way we had run blockades in the previous 200 years. That was not widely understood. And we had one hell of a time during the initial days in making clear that it wasn't a traditional blockade.
Blockade is normally an act of war in international law. And that word quarantine was very carefully chosen in order to avoid the term of blockade by our legal advisors. And a very important part of the success, or the rationale for it, was that we got the OAS states unanimously to approve a quarantine on the grounds of self-defense, which did not make it an act of war. And that word was very, very advisedly chosen.
Some precedent. I mean, the word that Roosevelt had used, you may recall.
Yes, he'd used
it. Damn little precedent in terms of operations.
But the word was used very advisedly, not just for political purposes, but to give international sanction to what we were doing.
And we did have international sanction. Two different issues here. One is
we had thousands, literally thousands of people involved in implementing the president's decision to quarantine Cuba. And they all had to have orders. We had planes flying all over the world. We had ships at sea. We had officers in the war rooms issuing instructions. We had messages flowing back and forth. And everyone had to be perfectly clear in their mind there was a difference between quarantine and blockade, or between, I'll say, an act of war and a non-act of war, or between starting a war and not starting a war, or between going beyond the president's narrow purpose and not going beyond it. The president was really trying to write a letter in terms that Khrushchev would understand. He sent messages by cable, of course, but he felt those would be possibly misunderstood, and he was, in a sense, writing a letter through the application of the quarantine. Now, that's quite different than what the Navy had been doing for 200 years.
And the difference, I think, can be expressed in another way, in terms of who really was going to decide what.
Very good.
Because the fact that the president was designing a communication meant that he had to consider each evolving step in that process of communication from the point of view of what he was trying to do. And that's why we have talked about, we talked in Atlanta about the president being a desk officer, and I remarked down there that he had an assistant desk officer. And when you have a desk officer and an assistant desk officer, and they decide that they will decide what ships will do what, it's not entirely surprising if the successors of John Paul Jones are startled.
Well, Mac uses the word John Paul Jones advisedly because this came up one night, and the assistant desk officer didn't leave the Pentagon, or slept at the Pentagon every night for 10 or 11 nights because of the necessity of being certain that in this very peculiar situation, the president's wishes and desires and decisions were clearly understood by everyone. And I recall very clearly one night, I think it was the Wednesday night after the quarantine became effective. Yeah. If I recall correctly, the quarantine became effective at 10 a.m. On a Wednesday morning.
On Wednesday morning, yes.
And at that night, we were looking ahead to the potential events of the next 24 hours. And it was apparent that at least one Soviet ship would approach the so-called quarantine line during that period. And the question was, what should be done? And the answer from, I'll call it the traditionalists, or the answer according to tradition, was obvious. Stop it. But it wasn't as obvious that stopping it was the action that would be most consistent with the president's decision. And it wasn't at all clear exactly how it would be stopped or what would happen if it were stopped. As it turned out, it was a tanker, and when one explored the ways in which one could stop a tanker, one could think about talking to it, radioing to it, or sending up signal flags and stopping it that way. But then if it didn't stop, what do you do? And you can fire across its bow, and if it still doesn't stop, you think about what to do. And the next level of pressure is to actually fire into the rudder or other parts of the tanker, and the damn thing might well have exploded. And you get quite a different level of pressure on Khrushchev than the president perhaps wished to apply at that time. And the traditionalists, in effect, said, well, McNamara, you don't seem to understand that for 200 years since John Paul Jones, he must have heard of this story because those were the exact words used. You don't seem to understand that for 200 years since John Paul Jones, the Navy has operated blockades very successfully, and we know that can do the same thing here. But this was not a blockade to be run in the tradition of the 200 years. And therefore, the actions had to be monitored and were monitored very, very closely. Both within the Pentagon and between the Pentagon and the National Security Council and the Office of the President. And I think, with hindsight, successfully. What actually happened in that case, as you know, is the tanker was allowed to proceed.
Well, you know, there's the great story, the earlier great story of the planes lined up wingtip to wingtip in Florida.
No, if I may interrupt you, the story was not quite that. The story was that we sent reconnaissance aircraft over Cuba, and they came back, and they showed pictures of the stupid damn Soviets and Cubans lining their planes up wingtip to wingtip. And we showed those to the president. The president said, well, I'm glad they're stupid. He said, by the way, he said, how are our planes lined up? He said, send reconnaissance planes over Florida. My God, they were lined up the same way.
Well, I'm sorry, I misstated it. That's a better story. It's hard to keep standard operating procedures from operating.
Well, what do you think if this kind of monitoring had to go into a third week?
I think it can continue indefinitely. What you have to have is purpose, intent, understanding. And that I think we had at the top. We had it at the presidential level. I hope we had it at my level. We had a chairman of the Joint Chiefs that was absolutely superb, the highest possible sense of integrity. I'm speaking of Max Taylor. And when you have those three layers determined to monitor, I don't think that an extension of time need weaken the monitoring. You just, you know, you replace one person with a deputy or whatever, and you, and also over time you begin to clarify. The common law begins to develop precedence and understanding.
That's as long as you're running a quarantine.
Well, under whatever situation, what I'm really suggesting is I think that if it's very clear that the president is in control, is making decisions, and that was clear in this situation, and if it's very clear that the secretary is acting for him and with his full authority, and if you have a chairman of the Joint Chiefs who is strong, experienced, and absolutely determined to carry out the decisions and the desires and the thoughts of the president and the secretary, then I think this kind of monitoring can go on indefinitely, and you just get organized to ensure that it does.
But let me ask a question that may sharpen your question, because I think it's certainly true about the quarantine, which is, after all, the use of naval power in a situation where we had commanding superiority. Mm-hmm. That once you find that your object is to stop those ships or signal those ships that the president wishes stopped or signaled, and you have clear-cut chain, everything follows as Bob has just expressed it. One of the reasons precisely for choosing the blockade was that it was, even in anticipation, something that you could manage. And calling it a quarantine, you could manage it the better and explain it the better. And one of the reasons for rejecting the airstrike, especially the closer you looked at it, was that you did have this very important assertion of operational requirements. I'm not saying the president couldn't have ordered a single airplane to strike if he'd wanted to, but the problem would have been very different because it would have been against possible opposition. And running that kind of engagement, while you can do it in terms of the loyalty of your commanders, is very much harder in terms of the predictability of response or the character of the engagement that may pull you onward in the second, third, and fourth stages.
If you lost 10 planes out of your 50 sorties, it would have been...
Yeah, but I want to go back, though, and stress what I said, because... and this is not wishful thinking, and you'll think my thought was the father of the wish. That is not the case. But I want to say that we are living in a world in which, when there is conflict between the Soviet Union and the United States, or between the Warsaw Pact and NATO, I believe it must be monitored this way, and I mean literally this way, 24 hours a day by the president and the secretary and the chairman. And the reason I say that is that there are 6,000 nuclear warheads on the soil of Western Europe, and about 3,000 of those are within almost an artillery shot of the border. And those things can be overrun, and overrun very quickly.
Bob, I'll add to that.
If I may finish. And therefore, it is absolutely essential that in the future, when these two great powers, Warsaw Pact and NATO, come in military confrontation, that every single action be monitored as closely as they were during this situation.
Well, would you agree with this much? Excuse me, because I think I'm defending my position in the face of an oblique attack from my learned friend. But I think you're right. But doesn't it follow that the level of direct military conflict that we can tolerate between the United States and the Soviet Union without the gravest risk that this kind of control becomes unmanageable is really quite low compared to what we have understood in the past.
Yes, but maybe we can't avoid
some.
And we blunder into it. I don't believe that. I know we don't want a conflict with the Soviet Union. I don't really believe the Soviet Union wants one with us. But we can certainly blunder into it. And as a matter of fact, I would guess that within the next 10, 15 years, we will blunder into it, hopefully low level. And what I'm suggesting is that one of the lessons the Cuban Missile Crisis is, in this nuclear age, the president and the secretary and the chairman must personally monitor every single action 24 hours a day. Now, it gets much more difficult when you have troops engaged on a broader front. No, I understand, but it's got to be done that way.
I add to that I most thoroughly agree
and my lectures to war colleges and chiefs and so on, I always phrase it in terms that the president in this day and age, the nuclear age, is going to require and demand absolute control.
Yes.
Yeah. Whenever, and our communications, our command arrangements, not only in defense, but also in state as well, our ambassadors, have to be such that they are immediately responsive to the president's, exactly. The president's wishes.
Well, and there's nobody from a White House type to say that that's a bad idea.
No, I think it's, you raise a valid point. At what point does it become, ascend to a scale that does it become impossible? Yeah. But I think it's a very, very important point to be made. And I don't think it's fully accepted yet.
No, I don't think it's accepted.
The tradition runs the other way. The ambassador is tired of getting instructions from the department, let alone instructions from the White House.
I know, but we're accustomed to responding to a president
a little bit.
But it certainly runs the other way in the American military tradition.
Sure.
The commander in the field is...
You assign a mission, and he's given the responsibility for carrying it out. And I always say that those days are over. Those days are over.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to know... well, never mind. Another aspect of monitoring...
If I interrupt your thought, I'd love to know whether the Soviets have the same view and are prepared and capable of doing it. And if they aren't, we ought to be talking to them about it. Because it takes two to hold down this level of risk in a nuclear age. I'm sorry I interrupted you, Dick, but I...
That's for dead, Ryan.
We ought to be discussing these kinds of subjects with them. This is another lesson from this conflict. Some people have said, well, nuclear weapons really didn't play a part in the Cuban Missile Crisis in the sense of we never intended to use them. That's certainly the case. But it's not true that they weren't on our minds.
Yeah.
And those of us who
That's an important distinction.
Well, it is an important distinction, and it relates to today because to the point we were
talking about.
Because those of us who were concerned about the Soviet reaction to airstrikes or invasion didn't believe that the Soviet political leaders, even in the face of a massive airstrike or an invasion, would authorize, or thought it unlikely, I should say, that the Soviet political leaders would authorize the launch of a nuclear weapon from the island of Cuba against the U.S. But we didn't know that they had the power to prevent it.
Yeah.
And in the face of a military strike by the U.S. against a missile site, or an invasion, we couldn't be sure that the second lieutenant in command wouldn't, perhaps quite properly in his mind, feel that it was his responsibility to launch the nuclear weapon before it was destroyed.
Well, they must have some comparable worries.
Well, this explains why we all got 10 years older in 2 weeks.
But what it also emphasizes, I think, is that we ought to have more certainty about what their controls are, and they ought to have more certainty about what ours are. And we both ought to think more about how to minimize the risk of these weapons. The weapons aren't going to be destroyed so quickly that we won't have opportunity to use them if we wish to. God forbid we would ever wish to. But what we must try to do is avoid using them before we wish to, or being pressured into using them when we would find it to our disadvantage to use them if we'd had more time or more certainty they could be protected.
I'm intrigued by the thought, following up your thought, intrigued by the thought of having Soviets and Americans without operational responsibilities, and not to negotiate with each other, but having continuity within their governments and continuity within their departments, sit down and discuss these matters such as this, including where are we going on the on this nuclear escalation, in a as abstract a manner as you can get, but to exchange thoughts on it and get a dialogue going on it that's not dependent upon changes in our government, not dependent on Soviet changes in the Soviet government, but to get some dialogue going and try to develop some common doctrines and channels that could be used and applied in cases of emergency. I realize the difficulties on it, But I think that the stakes are so high.
Realize the danger of not doing it.
Yeah, that's it. Exactly. Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. We've got to find some way of doing it.
Mm-hmm. You need to underline, too, I think, the point that practice in communication really does enter in. That is to say that if you have this kind of thing going and you use it even for quite different things,
yes,
and the president uses it, and the chairman uses it, and they get some sense of the way each other are as
yes,
communicating persons, then if you have this kind of danger, I don't say that it makes it easy, but it increases the chance that you will avoid some catastrophic misunderstanding.
I most certainly agree.
Well, of course, it was the exchange of personal letters in this case that made
yeah,
all the
but
difference.
That was between the two presidents. Yeah.
And didn't but have the wider context
the wider
you're talking
context
about.
That I'm,
both
I'm
were
talking
help.
About.
Alex, you wanted to bring up a question. I think we ought to insert it right here for a minute and then go to the negotiations that took place, semi-negotiations that took place late in the second week of this crisis. It's another example of very good management. The effort made in the State Department to get simultaneous notification and diplomatic initiative started with all the OAS governments and with all our European allies all at once. I don't know whether the state has ever managed anything on that scale before or since, for that matter.
No.
But it was very effectively done.
I don't think that we have. And I think that that was the time that we had to do that. We were given 24 hours from Saturday midnight until Sunday midnight before the president's speech to send out personal messages from the president to some 15, 16 chiefs of state to brief our ambassadors.
To put them in position, you mean, but, because they weren't delivered until the Monday, I think.
Oh, no, they were not. This is a pre-position, getting all these things pre-positioned. We sent out some 450 messages in those 24 hours containing presidential messages, containing the text of the president's speech, containing a resolution for the Security Council, instructions to our ambassadors, getting all our ambassadors in Latin America back to their posts, and having them poised to see the chief of state there as quickly as they could after the speech, to get their agreement to the OAS resolution, so that, and all the things that we also did in NATO, dispatching Dean Acheson to see de Gaulle. All of these things took a lot of time, even under the best of circumstances. And I feel that a part of the success of the Cuban operation from our standpoint was the fact that when this got surfaced, we had a solid phalanx in Latin America for the first time. We had a solid phalanx in Europe. We had every chief of every government, a non-communist government in the world, that had been briefed on this. And Khrushchev found himself faced with a solid wall of support, or support for the United States in general in this. And I think it had a great effect upon his decision to see that, or to throw in the towel, and see that he had to respond to this. They had not done anything comparable at all. They had done no contingency planning. They had not lined up any support. And it became very, very evident.
They didn't even have a line.
They didn't have a line for several cases. And what I'm saying is, I think that this was a big factor in the success of the operation. Yeah. I always point to it, of course, as being, to my mind, a model of the use of military power and diplomacy together to accomplish a major national objective without ever being required to fire a shot.
Well, let me say it was an extraordinary technical performance on the part of the career service. I never was more pleased in my life with the State Department.
Led by Alex.
Led by Alex.
I wasn't asking for that. But
No, I was going to say
that's true.
Well, that's one of those things. There are very few times in this world where you hear just those words said.
Well, one other comment on the career service. The unsung heroes of this whole operation were the Thompsons and the Bolins and the Kennons. It's true, George Kennan wasn't in the country at the time, and Bolin left for Paris in the middle of it. But Tommy was here the whole time, and all three of them had built up an understanding through a lifetime of study of the Soviet Union and their behavior that was the foundation of advice to those of us who were not as experienced as they, and I think was the foundation of the president's confidence in the advice he received,
and substantially
shaped the president's approach to
question about it.
Thompson
was absolutely fantastic because everything he predicted worked out exactly as he said it would.
Let me give you a very specific example because it relates to the original problem of just one fragment, Alex, and I'll be out of your way. It relates to the initial choice and takes us back to that. One of the worries that bothered some of us who were doubtful about the blockade quarantine in the early stages was that it looked to us as if it might easily lead to a response against Berlin. And there was a certain surface plausibility to that. That was the first British Foreign Office reaction
and
the beginning
we'd been
of the following
Berlin
week.
Troubles.
And we'd been having Berlin troubles. Tommy thought about that. And I remember very well his saying in George's conference room, I just don't think they think that way. They will not think that a reply to a naval action in the Caribbean should be a major assault on Western Europe and on all the other countries that that would involve. And he was surely right.
One other thing that he said at that time, which impressed me very much because it was rather a novel idea to me, when we were talking about the question of getting the OAS approval and the UN and so on, he said this is terribly important because the Soviets are very legalistic.
I recall that.
Remember
as well,
that?
George.
Yes.
Bourgeois.
Well, all I was going to say, I entirely agree with, you know, Tommy. Chip was only there for the first couple of days, but Tommy contributed so much to it. But what I was going to say was, you know, Tommy just didn't grow in a tree that during the course of that crisis. He had been gone into the Foreign Service years and years before, and he'd been nurtured and trained, and he had the experience.
We understand that he was in FSO 8, 7, 6.
That's right. Well, and, I'd just like to say a word for the importance.
Of course.
Importance, I think, of what our professional service can do and the service that it can be these times. It requires, though, that it be nurtured and continued.
And it requires something I'm not that sure that we do as well now as we did with that generation, namely to give the professional time to master in depth what is not the whole world, but is a major fraction of it.
No, we don't. We don't.
We don't have anything like those two services now.
No,
this is one of the reasons.
We don't even have it in the Japan and the China service.
No, I was just going to say, one of the reasons I raised it, because by contrast,
yes,
during the so much of the Vietnam period, we were left with the vacuum that had been created by the McCarthy days in the mid-50s. And today, it's my impression, just looking at it from the outside, that the service is not permitted to specialize, as Max said, to provide professionals with the time to pick up the languages, to pick up the culture, to study the history, to become lifetime experts in a particular area of the world.
Well, that's music to my ears. I could go on with that. But,
yes, sir.
I think it's actually not your ears we're shooting at.
It's one of the lessons I think we need to draw from. This is why I want to express my thought on it, because as an outsider who could hardly spell Soviet Union, if it hadn't been for the experts that we had from state, I would have been working without a solid foundation of knowledge. And I think so many of our civilian appointees in the upper ranks in the government are in that position. And it's the foundation of expertise that is built up in particular parts of the government, in the military or in the CIA or particularly in the State Department, that is absolutely essential. And I do not believe today our society puts the premium on it that it should.
Well, we can go on with this, but of course we've...
But it's a lesson from the period.
With the administration now changing every 4 years, as it has ever since Eisenhower, and each new administration coming into office on the policy or the platform of throwing the rascals out, our service is being very, very badly denied.
Or denigrating the senior people in the
because they're contaminated.
Bureaus.
They're contaminated with the previous administration.
Yeah.
Yes. And you see, you link that, Bob, to your command and control.
Yeah.
It's
yeah.
depressing.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, it's. If I were in the Soviets, I'd have no confidence in this control you talk about. Why should they? Over on our side. I mean, Anyway, I wanted to ask you, gentlemen, about one final aspect of this business. The second Saturday. First, there was the trollop ploy. I got a minor question. I've never understood why that was such an all-fired genius of an idea. It seems to me more or less standard. Am I wrong? Now, correct me.
No, I wouldn't say it was a standard at all. It seemed quite obvious. But that second message we got, we had to assume had been sent after the first message.
Yes.
And we had to assume that something had happened to change his mind.
Moreover, it was perfectly clear that that second message was written by a committee. It was the staff view of the Soviet government.
Yes. That's right. Clear. Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
But
okay.
It was. You can say now that it looks kind of obvious that you should do the trollop ploy and pick up the first one, but thank goodness we did it. And it was the thing to do, and it worked. I don't know. Why it wasn't obvious at the time, I might say.
No, that's what I wanted to get.
I think the shock of the second message is understandable, because we had, after a period of very severe tension,
yes,
thought we saw in the Friday
message, the beginnings of a
resolution, and now we're confronted with all the stuffpot bureaucratic prose on a very different line, and that's a shock. I agree with you if the point of your question is that it would have been stupid if we hadn't worked our way to something like the trollop ploy, some way of reproposing the parts that we agreed with and not wasting too much time on frantic argument over the things we didn't agree with. That was good sense, but it was good sense produced initially by Bob Kennedy at a moment of great tension, and that's a major contribution.
Absolutely, and I can recall leaving the White House after it had been decided which message to reply to, and after the reply had been drafted and approved by the president, and it was being sent out. It was a Saturday evening. I can remember the sunset. We left about the time the sun was setting in October, and I at least was so uncertain as to whether the Soviets would accept replying to the first instead of the second, or accept, in a sense, our acceptance of the formula of the first, that I wondered whether I'd ever see another Saturday sunset like that.
I think, now, I think
that may sound overdramatic, but
I think
that
many
was
of us
the way
the
I
same
was
way.
Feeling at the time. Yep. It was that serious a problem. That was Saturday night.
That's right. No, I think many of us felt that.
And that's because you were looking ahead to Tuesday or whatever day it
exactly.
was.
Exactly.
And then Wednesday. Yeah.
Exactly.
So escalation after the
that
after
is,
next.
That is right. And the possible, and it was a very tiny possibility, I understand, Dick, but the possible effect on our country of even one of those warheads, nuclear warheads.
Well, Bob, you and I were walking through the Rose Garden the following morning and the weather was most beautiful weather I could ever remember.
I recall that. It was
and
glorious.
I said, walking through the Rose Garden, this reminds me of a Georgia O'Keeffe painting of a rose coming up through an ox skull. And that was exactly the kind of...
We hadn't had the reply yet.
That's right.
No,
yes.
We hadn't.
Tell me one other thing. Paul Nitze was represented to me by a couple of his assistants on that night at that time, who received him when he got back to his office. He was your assistant secretary, who had a rather different view of a lot of these matters. As terribly depressed about the day, but for a quite different set of reasons. He worried about about Robert Kennedy's mission to Dobrynin, and he was appalled at the notion of, as it's been told to me, of defusing the missiles in Turkey.
Dick, I don't have that recollection.
And okay, that's why I'd like to get.
Let me give you one reason
it's been,
why I think it's unlikely.
Right.
I don't have a recollection at all. And I think it's unlikely because, frankly, I don't believe Paul knew of the decision, which had been taken by that time.
He had left.
Of removing the missiles from Turkey. Because I didn't tell anybody. And there were only a handful of people, five or six.
We're talking about the same thing. There was a defusing of missiles in Turkey. That is to say, rendering them incapable of firing without an authority, which occurred during that week, did it not?
I think Paul did react to that.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't that Saturday that they were defused.
That would have happened earlier.
Okay. That's right.
It may have happened.
So
it happened late in the day.
No, but what happened? No, but what happened on the Saturday?
I can tell you what happened.
It was quite a different action. And I don't think Paul knew of it. In any event, I don't myself recall the incident you're speaking of.
Dick, on this... I'm quite sure Paul did not know about the quite separate question of readiness to remove the missiles from Turkey.
That's what you meant by the...
In regard, he didn't know about that.
I don't think so either, Dick.
Yes. In regard to the course of action, I know it said that Paul was... This quarantine, that Paul was not in support of this. All I can say is that Paul and I...
It was Saturday morning that he ordered the missiles defused.
Paul and I drafted the scenario that set forth the program that was eventually followed. We worked very, very hard at this. I on the diplomatic side and he on the military side.
No, I think by the time
and
the
he worked, he... He worked most intimately on this and most full support of it insofar as my association with him was concerned.
I think by the time the decision was made to move the blockade, and certainly after it was made, which would include that Saturday, Paul was not pressing for
it. We can't hurt you now, Alex.
Yeah. Okay.
Well, I only raise it because for 20 years people have gone around talking about Paul's views, and I thought since we haven't been able to lure him into this for natural understanding reasons, given his assignments.
I normally sat next to him in the XCOMs and this, and we had a very close relationship, and I never felt that he was objecting when the decision was finally made. No. I think we all were on both sides of the question throughout that week, and we all gradually came, as we said.
One should make an underline to this point that whatever the differences of opinion and arguments and preferences had been in the period leading up to the decision, I don't think there was any question. There wasn't a single member of XCOM who didn't track with each decision as the president made it along, which isn't to say that a particular officer may not have been discouraged by the tenor of discussion on a particular day. That's quite possible. But I think we ought to come back, if you agree, Dick, to the messages Bob actually carried, Bob Kennedy, on the Saturday, because those certainly were important, and we haven't talked about them at this session.
Now, these are the messages that he took personally to Dobrynin, making clear, as I understand it, that there would be no trade of Turkish missiles for Cuban missiles, but that we understood the Turkish missiles to be obsolescent, the missiles in Turkey and Italy to be obsolescent. President had decided to have them removed before this ever arose, and In the normal course, they would be removed soon after, but that if that was ever represented as a trade, well, it was unacceptable. Have I got it about right?
Well, that's my understanding of what the president decided. That's my understanding of what he authorized Bobby to say, and as far as I know, he said it exactly like that. And I must, one further point. He was instructed to make clear that if the Soviets ever discussed this, we would deny it. And the point I was going to make was that we did remove the missiles. I think this was a very important point from Khrushchev's personal point of view within the Soviet government. He undoubtedly had to tell other people that this had been told to him by President Kennedy. There wasn't, to the best of my knowledge, one single leak by either government. It was a remarkable action.
Yeah. No, I think
we did remove the missiles.
How much trouble did you have with that? There was another case where we had the right man as assistant desk officer.
Well, I went back. I went after the president had authorized this. I told him I'd personally handle it. I went back and I called John McNaughton, who was a marvelous man, all of you knew, and who, as you know, was killed in an accident shortly after. And I said, John, I'm going to tell you something. I don't want you to ask any questions about it. I don't want you to say to anybody else why it's being done, because I'm not going to tell you. I just want you to do it. I want every single missile removed out of Turkey. I want them taken to Italy. I want them cut up. I want photographs of them, and I want it done by X date, and I want the photographs in my hand. Now do it. Don't ask questions. Just do it. And he did it.
Yeah. I understand he had considerable problem, though, with your department.
Yes, there was some
playing its usual role.
Well, of trying.
No, I don't recall that there was a... People... Nobody in our department. Nobody in our. I can recall in our department.
A lot of people must have wondered why it was being done and had it been properly prepared for, which it had.
Well, no. The concern in my department was had the Italian and the Turkish government been prepared for,
which they hadn't been.
Yeah, which they hadn't been.
Well, except we've been talking to them for a long time.
Oh, but
as I recall, I got most of the blame in the books for it.
No, they've been saying, don't do it.
Would you like some unfair credit?
But the important point here, Dick, is the president made the decision to have them removed long before the missile crisis.
And we're doing a whole series of discussions.
That's a very, very important
with the Turkish government, primarily with the Turkish government.
Yes.
And they were not, theoretically, say they were committed to NATO. They were something where NATO was involved. I mean, it wasn't purely a unilateral decision that the United States could make.
And that's what,
of course, by that time we were hoping that there would be the Polaris would be sufficiently present so that the missiles wouldn't be needed anyway, and because they probably didn't work.
Yeah.
You know, years later, in fact, just this last year, I found myself reading a memorandum of a meeting in the Oval Office in the next preceding administration, in which a message is delivered to President Eisenhower to the effect that senior commanders are beginning to question the usefulness of the short-range missiles in Turkey, to which his reply is, but I always told them they shouldn't do that.
Now, this is a very interesting point. Yeah. Here again, we're talking about military realities on the one hand and perceptions on the other, which were misperceptions but had become reality in place of the underlying reality. The missiles were worthless in the Eisenhower administration. They sure as hell were worthless and known to be worthless in the Kennedy administration. And yet, because the Soviets, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, said, we won't remove our missiles from Cuba unless you remove yours from Turkey, there was almost a requirement that we go to war with the Soviets to preserve missiles in Turkey that were worthless. Now, there was a real danger at one point that
State of mind would take over.
Exactly. Exactly. And one of our great achievements, it seems to me, was we avoided that.
That is what was bugging the president at the end.
I recall him saying very, very well, I am not going to go to war over worthless missiles in Turkey. Don't want to go to war anyhow, but I am certainly not going to go to war over worthless missiles in Turkey. Now, I don't know how to get out of this. We eventually figured out how to get out of it. But I mention this because there are so many misperceptions existent in the world today that are driving
very
us.
Much so.
So many military things affairs, that aren't important are stated to be vital,
which become major issues between states and between NATO and the Warsaw Pact, and could lead to war.
Pershing's
a good illustration. Well, let's cut that out of this tape. We don't want to lose credibility, George.
What do you mean lose credibility? Let's affect the action.
Yes, sir. Have we ever put on record the genesis of that mission of RFK's to Debrinen?
Well, let me describe it as I remember it, and then George and Bob, who were both there, will correct and amend. We had been meeting in the Oval Office. We'd reached the conclusion that we would make the soft answer, accepting the Friday terms. No invasion of Cuba, you take your missiles out, essentially. Then we get into the Oval Office, and I don't want to be held to the exact persons present, but as I recall it, the President, Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, Deputy Secretary of State, or Undersecretary, were you then?
Under, yeah. I never was anything else.
That was enough for you, George. With you, it was the
that
same.
That was all there was to deputy. Me, George. Yeah.
And then there was Gilpatrick, the number two man in the Pentagon, and Ted Sorensen, and me, and I think that's who was there. And the question was exactly how would and of course the Attorney General, who was to be the emissary, how would he convey the message? And we went up and down, sorted out how to convey the general agreement with the first letter. And then, as I recall it, the Secretary of State said, Dean Rusk said, can't we say to him that we can get those missiles out of Turkey?
I think it was the president's.
I know the president picked it up instantly. He'd been saying it all day long.
That's right, he had.
He had been saying it all day long, and the record shows him saying it at various earlier times and saying the kind of thing you described. And what I think happened was that the secretary pushed on a point that he knew the president cared about. We then hammered back and forth on it and reached the conclusion that we could say it, and I don't recall the inputs at all as to the particular formulations, reached the formulation we have described, that we could say what had been our intention for a long time, what was our clear purpose soon after the crisis, as long as it were not connected to the crisis, as long as nobody represented it as a quid pro quo, which it was not, it was a settled intent, and as long as nobody tried to make an open affair of it, about the way you described it a minute ago. Yeah. And that was not a long meeting. That might have been a 20-minute meeting.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important for one or another, whoever wants to pick up this theme, to distinguish that private qualified assurance from shenanigans, which, again, 20 years later, lots of people find a hard distinction to make. I don't have any trouble with it, but lots of people do. So I want to give you your chance to make the distinction. What was the reason why this could not be publicly acknowledged?
None of us was able to figure out a way of explaining it publicly. It didn't look as if it wouldn't be taken by many people as a sellout of our ally.
Yeah, and furthermore, you have to recall that this was in the context of a column that Walter Lippmann had, in which Lippmann had proposed that the solution of this problem be through a trade. You have to remember that this was a position that Adlai Stevenson had tried to sell the XCOM. When he came down from New York, that it should be a bargain.
And you have to recall also that the Lippmann column had led to intense outcries of opposition
from the Turks and other members
and
of NATO
from London.
Yes, exactly. Other members of NATO and from the Turks.
So the ground had not been prepared at that point.
Right.
If we had
if the message
so we Khrushchev, couldn't do it publicly, couldn't do it properly. It wouldn't have worked. It would have been gravely against our interest, the interest of the alliance. It would have given Khrushchev, in political terms, a victory rather than.
Yeah, he would have said, "I got something out of this, and therefore it was a good thing to do."
Then one step further, and then I know what Bob says is going to be the punchline. But just one further small point, namely that President had the authority to say what he said. He wasn't saying, "I'll go to the Congress." He wasn't saying, as another president said in another context, "I'll support you if they violate the truce." He was saying, "I, as president, assure you that these missiles will be gone." He was talking about something he had the authority to do and could execute.
Mm-hmm. I was simply going to add that it was important to frame it exactly as it was framed, because don't forget we were dealing not with a military problem but with a political problem. And if we had not framed the withdrawal of the missiles from Turkey as we did, we would have created another political problem. We would have divided the alliance.
Right.
We would have weakened it.
Right.
And the Soviets would have faced a weakened alliance, and this would have been a danger to the
propaganda
alliance.
Value against us in Europe would have been, here is the United States
selling.
Once they're faced with some missiles themselves in Cuba, they're prepared to sell NATO out.
Yeah. Decoupling.
Yeah. And again, I think because of the advice we'd had from Tommy, there was a high probability the Soviets would accept the explanation that was given to them and adhere to the terms, because they could have seriously weakened us had they disclosed those terms.
It occurs to me as I listen to Bob that very probably Tommy Thompson was in that room. It's very unlikely that the president would have worked out final instructions for a communication to the Soviet government at that stage of the crisis without Thompson.
I don't know that you've covered, Dick, as far as this settlement was concerned, that we not only got the missiles out, but we also got out, in the subsequent negotiations, the IL-28 bombers, 42 of them that were in there. They were of great concern to us. The bombers were not a part of the
We'd initially agreed to tolerate the bombers.
And we got the bombers out also.
Also because Thompson told the president he could.
He could, yes.
And one last word to attempt to recreate the environment of the time. After the missiles were removed and the bombers were removed, and after we had reconnaissance aircraft fly 25 feet off the decks, the freighters removing the missiles and the bombers, so low you could read the serial numbers on the missiles, and we had counted for every missile and every bomber gone.
Yeah.
It was still widely believed in the country that we'd been defeated. The Soviets had not taken them out. And you may remember there was therefore a live television program that went on for an hour and a half while John Hughes, who was the intelligence expert in the Defense Intelligence Agency, presented the pictures and presented the argument, and we then answered questions from the press to try to allay the fears of important parts of the U.S. public and the Congress that we'd been defeated, that the Soviets had not done what they said they would do. I mention this to show you the environment within which these decisions took place and why there was so much controversy over what alternative should be followed.
Mm-hmm. And let me make one other point here that is very important, I think, for the long-run future. We haven't had time to discuss it, but when you go back and look at this two-week period, one of the most important events, a controlling event, is the president's speech to the country. You go back and reread that speech today, and you'll see that to an astonishing degree, he laid out the reasons in the very political, wide-scale sense, not the missile counting sense, made the distinction that we've made in this discussion that Bob McNamara has made particularly, made the case that this was something to be settled in terms of
the long-run peace of the world, explained what was going to happen, and carried the country with him, became very clear.
Very good.
It's quite right that we had to have the right arrangement, a quarantine. It's quite right that we had to have the kind of diplomatic mass action that Alex organized. But the most important thing to have was the understanding and support of the American people, and that was established that evening and sustained through what was a very difficult week.
Very important point.
Mm-hmm. Gentlemen, anything you want to add before we conclude? We have about 1 minute.
Well, nobody, thanks to you, Dick, for taking the time to come down and lead us through this.
Nobody wants the last minute. So thank you very much.
Let the tape run.
Let the tape run. Yeah.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.